Friday Night Racing.
On Off the Ball.
And they're off.
Brought to you by Go Racing. Plan your day at the races at goracing.ie.
It's Friday Night Racing on a Friday afternoon. If you're catching the streams live on Facebook, on YouTube, or of course on Twitter, or perhaps you're listening to this live on the radio this evening at around about 8 o'clock, we're with you every Friday right here across offtheball.com and on all of our platforms, bringing you top class racing coverage. I wasn't here last week because I was in Kilbeggan. You didn't make the trip to Kilbeggan. You missed out.
No, I went to Galway United Bohemians.
In that game?
Yeah, they lost 2-0 Galway and a very poor crowd. And first, no real meaningful game now for about 6 months.
Right.
Pretty grim.
Should have gone racing, Johnny.
Should have gone racing. Went down with the Bulls fans. Had a good time. But how was Kilbeggan?
It's amazing. I'm fully on board with these smaller racetracks where you can just wander. It's a 5 minute walk to the parade ring, to the finish line, to the bar. It's very easy to get around.
Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great though. Like, I mean, and some race courses in England in particular, it's kind of segregated and, you know, it can feel like there's a lot of security, but those summer meetings in Ireland, it's such a friendly atmosphere. Like,
yeah.
Ballinrobe has one more meeting left, and obviously Sligo, Roscommon, and Galway into the autumn. And I think you can nearly stretch as far as Kilbeggan for those tracks. I would very much put in the same summer tracks that have great atmosphere.
Yeah, what purpose do they serve? So, Noel Mead was there, Gordon Elliott was there. I didn't see Willie Mullins, but somebody said he was there as well, and they all had horses there. Like, where does that fit within the rest of the kind of architecture of the season and how the racing calendar works?
Well, like, they're all winners. Like, so if Willie Mullins is going for the title, the winner he has in Kilbeggan, you know, whereas the prize money might be bigger later on in the season, it's still a winner. But you have summer horses who want prevailing kind of good to firm or goodish ground that basically just won't be running in the winter.
Right.
And the tracks are quite unique. You know, if you go to America to race over there, the tracks are pretty much all left-handed bowls. They're all the same. And in Ireland, we have totally different race tracks. Whereas, like, Navan and Kilbeggan would basically be like chalk and cheese, even though they're probably about an hour from each other. So you have to, you've horses that really want, they might want to go right-handed. They might want undulating tracks. They might be better suited by tight tracks. And being honest, they might want maybe the slightly more, you know, modest opposition that you will get in summer racing. But the standard of racing in Ireland, I think somebody said it on At The Races, an English commentator the other day, he said, you know, they keep the competitive racing up in the summer. Like, the standard of racing in Galway, for example, is just crazy high. Like, and this is a summer meeting, and Listowel in a week and a half's time, it'll be the same thing, like really good prize money. And also, you got to, you know, you have a great crowds at these meetings as well. It's actually good for the trainers, enjoy it.
Yeah, and they certainly seem to be less stressed and less pressurized than they are at some of the bigger events. But you do also forget sometimes that this is an entertainment industry. You need to put on your product. You need to have a good show, and like, certainly they've got that licked.
Yeah, but like, the challenge for racing going forward is going to be people's attention spans are getting shorter and shorter and shorter, such that the lad watching the football game now, he might spend 20% of the game either on his phone or on Twitter, right? And now, that I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but in any event, we've 30-minute gaps between races, so there's time to fill. And to make it a really nice, enjoyable social occasion, I think all the racetracks, they find that a challenge, and that's what they are trying to embrace, like having like family days and like having you know, things beyond racing. But
yeah,
ultimately, it's a really nice social occasion, like to go racing, meeting people, like, and just getting back to the old nature of actually socialising via talking to each other,
yeah,
meeting old faces,
as opposed to like buried in the phones. For sure. Look, we'll talk about some of the big stories in the racing world. We'll talk about Sam Crowe and Tiger Roll a little bit later on, and we'll also be previewing the racing at the Curragh. We have a trifecta courtesy of thetote.com this week, and that'll be an opportunity for us to explain how that works and also win, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of euros, hopefully, from
the
Jockeys Fund. In the meantime, though, I'm delighted to welcome our special guest this week. It's Dr. Adrian McGoldrick, who is joining us on Skype from the Curragh. Dr. McGoldrick, good afternoon to you. How are you doing?
I'm very well, Gerard. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Well, listen, thanks a million for joining us. Yours is one of those names that keeps cropping up in the various stories that we've been covering over the last while. And I think it might be no harm for us to do a little bit of a quick career retrospective, because I understand this is nearly the end of your time with the Turf Club. You've announced that you're going to retire fairly soon. So I always, in these instances, I'm interested in knowing just how embedded were you as a kid growing up in racing? Was it always something that you wanted to do, or did you kind of fall into it?
A case of probably falling into it. I'm originally from Rathangan, which is about 10 miles from here. So when I was young, I used to cycle over to the Curragh to the races. But that was the totality of it. Qualified in 76, went into practice in 1980 in Clonus for 5 years, came back to Newbridge in December 84, and I took over practice from Dr. Paddy Canty. Paddy was a racecourse doctor in the Curragh, and at the time, one of the doctors was retiring, so he asked me would I come on board at the Curragh. So I joined the Curragh 33 years ago as a local racecourse doctor, but we did very little then, and we just strolled around, had a drink during racing, and we really weren't very much involved. But as time went on, eased off his practice, I began to take over more of his patients, which was involved jockeys, trainers, and a lot of people involved in racing. At the same time, I was very interested in occupational medicine, and so I was doing a diploma in occupational medicine in UCD and with the College of Physicians, and I was trying to find a topic which really I really wanted to concentrate on. And I looked at the occupational medicine racing industry, and that's probably 22, 23 years ago, I did my thesis on it. That really got my interest going more and more. And I, at the same time, I was very friendly with Johnny Murta and knew the struggles Johnny was going through. And I suppose Johnny was the person probably I can thank or blame for having me where I am now. But I certainly got to know a lot of the lads. I was working at the Curragh, which was very straightforward. It's a flat track. I live literally a mile from the Curragh. And then about 13 or 14 years ago, I just got more and more concerned when I looked at the lads, at their dehydration, what they're doing to make weight. And I asked them, would they allow me to do a small study on them? The late Ned Going has a veterinary practice just across from the Curragh. So I spoke to Ned, and Ned converted his equipment to take human blood. So 11 of the senior jockeys allowed me to take blood before and after racing. And it proved what I always knew, that these guys were seriously dehydrated during racing. Now, I went looking in the literature, and there were only 4 papers actually on jockeys in all of the literature at the time. So coincidentally, at that time, the inquiry was going on into the safety aspects in racing in 2004. I made a presentation on making weight, and I made a recommendation that we should do further research. And I have to thank HRI in particular as funding it. And obviously, Dennis Egan, my chief executive at the Turf Club, they totally came on board and said, look, we do need to do more research. So I linked up with Giles Warrington. Giles was based in the University of Limerick, a senior sports physiologist who had been involved with a lot of the Olympic teams. And so from there, we started the Turf Club research team, which has expanded quite dramatically now. We have Sarah Jane Cullen, who came through as one of our PhD students. She's now a lecturer in Waterford, and she's now overseeing 2 of the 3 projects which we've up and running currently. So over the last 11 years, we've done quite a lot of research looking at different areas of racing, be it bone health, looking at dehydration, looking at the energy expenditure during racing, and trying to find out more about racing. Now, we do liaise with our colleagues internationally, obviously, to make sure we're not duplicating what we're doing. We've Gillian O'Loughlin as our senior dietitian for the last 10 years, looking at the dietetics. More recently, through the jockey pathway, we've Wayne Middleton, a strength and conditioning coach, working with our jockeys out of race. Curiosity sports psychologist, which is a very, very important element. We've got involved the last 2 years. And obviously, from a physiotherapy point of view, we've had John Butler for the last 10 years working with our jockeys on track. We've really expanded that. John's on track now. He's on 2 tracks every 2 weeks. So we really are rolling out, trying to provide the basic service any elite athlete should have. We're also trying to get across to the jockeys that they are elite athletes, and they must, again, work with us from a nutrition point of view, from an exercise point of view. And I think we're beginning to get there. As everybody probably knows, I do have a big bugbear about jockey weights for the last 20 years. I do still think it's something which has to be addressed internationally. We have addressed it locally. And again, I think I cannot thank the people in the Turf Club and HRI, the stewards, have backed me 110% in anything I've proposed in relation to weights. And with Giles and Sarah Jane. So we've got our weights up to the best we can do, both here and the UK again have backed us. The French haven't been as keen to come on board, but I would hope that in this year, or before this year is out, that we will get to an international meeting and just try and stress that we must get weights up, because our flat jockeys are riding 1.5 to 2 stone below the natural weight, which to me is just not acceptable. For me as a doctor, that is just not acceptable. And our jump jockeys are probably stone below the natural weight. So to me, that just is not right.
Yeah.
They're just
Let me come back to the weights, will you? Because it's fascinating, and it's certainly something that we've kind of talked about a good bit. Andy Lee, obviously a colleague of ours, has talked about making weight, and we've been with UFC fighters when they've been making weight as well, and it's a fairly horrific process. But I just wanted to bring you back to the bit where you were talking about getting into this, and is it fair to say that the personal stories of the jockeys who were your patients was the thing that made you realise that actually there needs to be an overarching structure here, that somebody like you and the people that you've listed out there needs a proper hierarchy and an architecture around them, that it was the individual cases first that kind of opened that door for you?
Absolutely, yeah. I just have to be living in Newbridge and forced to be taking care of a lot of the senior jockeys. And I saw what they were going through, and to me, it wasn't fair, it wasn't human to see what they're doing to make weight. And so I felt that we should put in place some structures. And again, as I said, I've been very, very fortunate. When I speak with my colleagues abroad, I've got absolute support to Dennis Egan and to the Turf Club stewards, the different stewards over the last 11 years while I've been in the senior role. Anything I've proposed to them, they've come on board and bought into it. In the beginning, when I was appointed, the first thing I wanted to do was to review our concussion guidelines. And again, it was a very expensive job. What I was proposing was certainly very expensive, but again, they bought into it because they could see the reason why we should have a very strict concussion protocol, which we've had in place for 10 years now. All of our riders, both amateur and professional, have based on neuropsych testing done every 2 years. So that if they do have a fall, then we can reassess them against their baseline. So we're very, very, as a sport, very lucky that all 500 plus riders do have a based on neuropsych test. So I can gauge them against that when I'm getting them back to returning them to racing again.
Have you seen a change in the attitude from the jockeys from the time that you started talking to them about the perils of making weight and about using the science of a dietitian and all that kind of stuff? Because we've even noticed it in the 16 years that we've been making radio that there was a natural suspicion from the older guard of the whole notion of sports psychology, for instance, and proper dietitian. It was like, well, look, I'm going to have a square of chocolate today and I'm going to have a spoonful of sugar in my tea and that'll be me done in terms of nutrition for the next 24 hours or for the 24 hours before a meeting. It seems as if there's been a massive sea change.
There has been, very definitely. And I mean, it's not just in Ireland. You can see in the UK have fantastic structures in place. Same with my colleague Ben Massan in France. Yeah, there's been a major sea change, particularly in Western Europe. But it's come back to home. Yeah, I mean, they now accept the early athletes. They must diet. They're in the gym. They're over Wayne Middleton. They're getting the strength conditioning. They're attending Curiosity Sports Psychologists. Again, I thought that would probably be the most difficult thing to sell was to get them to go and see Kira. But I got one or two of the senior jockeys to go and speak with Kira. They went back and sold it to younger lads. If they see the senior jockeys, if it's acceptable for them to speak sports psychologists, well, then it was okay for them to do it. So that was very important. Again, as regards running, again, Johnny Murtagh was one of the first jockeys to went out there running, because again, had this concept that if they ran, it would actually put on weight, that they would actually put on muscle. But of course you don't, you burn off fat and you change your lean body mass. And again, we now have a lot of riders are running. Again, if you go to any race meeting, you'll see some of the lads running on the track before the races, which is great. And I would like to see more of them doing it, being very honest.
Yeah. Johnny, it's funny, like you think back to how the Premier League gets revolutionised by Arsene Wenger coming in and saying, why are you all drinking so many pints? What's the story with that, lads? And maybe we might try, not having the fatty food that you have in the canteen after training. These revolutions come and then science takes over, and the accepted nature of the fact that you are elite athletes and need to treat yourself that way. It seems like racing has been kind of undergoing that process over the last two decades as well.
Yeah, and still is as well. And if you go to certain race meetings where you've kind of access to the weighing room, you'll still see like three or four jockeys outside having a smoke between racing. And I'm definitely interested in Dr. Adrian's views on that, because I know, I remember doing a piece to him before about this, but it's one of those areas where I think we're probably still, we still have a bit of work to do.
Yeah, Johnny, look, as you know, a lot of these guys may not have eaten for 24 hours before they take a ride because making weight. They use cigarettes as, again, it decreases your diet. So obviously
hunger suppressing, kind of.
It's basically hunger suppressing, absolutely. And it's something to keep them occupied with. But cigarettes are hunger suppressants, unfortunately. It's one of their side effects. And that's one of the reasons they smoke and have nothing else to do. I mean, genuinely, a lot of them would not have eaten for 24 hours. And you smell the ketones off their breath. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons we've been pushing about the nutrition, all the different aspects I mentioned earlier on. But obviously, as I keep coming back, that we do need to look at increasing waste, you know, down the line. But yeah, cigarette smoking, look, is something we obviously would love to see them all giving up. But it's like saunas, it's part and parcel of racing and will be for the foreseeable future.
You mentioned obviously the sports psychologist, which I'm very interested in. I didn't really know there was much of that in racing. But you did an interesting study on mental health as well. Obviously, we had an interesting piece recently with Mark Enright, and he obviously extolled your role in his, I suppose, progression. But you did a study as well, didn't you, just to look into kind of mental health and jockeys that produced some quite remarkable results.
Yeah, after Mark had that episode of depression, I mean, Mark just was the tip of the iceberg of what is happening within racing. So after Mark opened up in the racing post in the field, several other jockeys approached me about the depression. So I spoke with Sarah Jane Cullen, our sports psychologist down in Waterford, and she, along with Kira Lasty, I asked them, would they look at doing a study online of jockeys? And we had 112 jockeys replied, both some from the UK as well. And within the 20 to 35 age bracket, the average would be 26% would have symptoms of depression. We came in at 57% in our professional jockeys. So we doubled the rate of depressive symptoms within racing. So naturally, as part of that, we proposed two things. One, we need to get a sports psychologist involved. And we're very lucky that we have Kira Lasty involved as WIT. But we also have a full backup 24/7 emergency number through the industry assistance program, which is funded through HRI and also through the Jockeys Trust. We also provide backup services. But certainly we realized then that we had a major problem. But now obviously the next step was, why do we have these problems? In the initial questionnaire, we only scratched the iceberg, the tip of the iceberg, but we now have a full-time four-year research fellow based out of WIT looking at depression in racing. So we would hope that in the next 2.5 years, we will hopefully have found the underlying, not just the underlying causes, but put structures in place to manage it into the future.
It strikes me that when you were dealing with the jockeys and they were just your patients, you must have realized that they don't really have anybody who advocates for them as a group. They don't really have the power of a single trainer, and they don't have job security. It's an unbelievably difficult thing, and they're very lucky to have somebody who can kind of come along and say, okay, actually, I can diagnose what the issues are here and I can explain to the industry why we need to help them.
Yeah, well, look, I keep saying probably the, if anybody's asked me what is the most important thing I've achieved in the last 11 years, it's probably getting the trust. I think that's been the most important. Once you have that, you can do anything. And again, I've been very lucky that within Ireland, I have a racing authority which allows me to be the advocate for the jockeys, because at the end of the day, the IHRB, the former trust, turf club, are my employer. So my role is to basically do as is directed in my contract. But they know that the jockeys come first in my life. And so, and then they're quite happy to live with that. And so that if I advocate on behalf of the jockeys, they know the reason why I'm doing it.
Yeah. And I guess it must be fulfilling then from your perspective as well, that like people like Mark Enright come out and say that that has a meaningful impact, but that there is an openness in the aftermath of that, that you're not just doing this for one person, that ultimately these are stories that do tip the scales and do begin to affect real change.
It's quite remarkable actually, Ger, after Mark wrote the piece in the Racing Post and then followed up in the field, the amount of trainers and jockeys approached me, obviously mainly jockeys. And I actually was just commenting, in the last 6 months, I've probably spent as much time, if not longer, dealing with psychological problems in jockeys as with injuries. I would see an average 1 or 2 jockeys a week with psychological problems. And of course, they take a lot longer to deal with than obviously a straightforward injury. But at least they're coming forward, ringing me and coming down to visit me in my surgery in Newbridge, or speaking with them online, referring them on for counselling, etc. I mean, we've been very lucky again to have the back of the Jockeys Trust and injured jockeys from the fundum. I mean, last year alone, we admitted 4 jockeys to St. Pat's with severe depression. On 3 they were in for 3 weeks, 1 that was in for 6 weeks, fully funded through the Jockeys Trust, and we split it 50-50 with the Irish Injured Jockeys Fund. So they're very lucky also in racing that they have this backup. But again, it's their money. I mean, this is money which is deducted from their fee. And so if they do get ill, they have the backup to know they can ring me and I will liaise with the IGF and the Irish Jockeys Fund, and if they need admission to a hospital, we can get that for them. So it works both ways, being very honest.
Like, this is staggering stuff now, where he's talking about having to deal more with psychological issues than dealing with physical injuries in what is clearly one of the most dangerous sports in the world in terms of physical injuries, and the fact that lots of jockeys, as he referred to there, are basically wasting a lot, and they're not eating properly. They work extreme hours at times, they're travelling a lot, and a hell of a lot of them are just struggling professionally, in the sense of they're not really riding winners and their confidence is low, and one thing leads to another. And I think what Mark Enright has done, and what obviously by extension Dr. Adrian has done, actually other sports could look into this in terms of 24/7 call line. We don't want another tragedy in sport. We don't want another tragedy in Irish life. We have too many of them in that regard, and I can't say enough for what he's done in that regard. More, I suppose, more so since Mark Enright came in, but it's really revolutionary, and I think that's a great kind of support for jockeys who are obviously struggling. As you mentioned there, I wasn't even aware of those figures with St. Pat's, and it's going to be like that, and they have to realise that there is help there and that they can get through it, and I think he's done an amazing job in that regard.
Yeah. Adrian, what is the underlying, like, I know you've got a 4-year project undergoing, you're only a year and a half into it by the sounds of it, but from your own instinct and from your own experience and having kind of dealt with jockeys for 4 or 5 decades at this point, what do you think are the underlying causes that you have a prevalence of 57% of people exhibiting?
I think there are several things, Ger. I mean, they work very long hours. There's uncertainty in the job. A very small percentage will actually make it. If you look at that, of the number of, I have 170 professional jockeys, probably 10% of them are actually making a living. The rest of them are probably just struggling to make a living. As I say, they work long hours. It's very stressful. They're not guaranteed if they're going to get a ride. Some might only get a ride 3 or 4 times a year. So trying to keep making weight for that occasional ride among the younger lads is quite difficult. And I said about pay structures in racing. We all know that they're not at the top end of the scale. So the combination of all of those things, I think, just make it's a very difficult profession. And again, there are extremely dedicated young men and women involved in it. But I think there are a lot of factors. There are probably some the study will bring out that I'm not aware of. But I would hope at the end of the day that we will find the cause. More importantly, put the structures in place to help them. And that's the more important thing.
Can the weights move? Can everybody just decide it's okay for everybody to be 4 pounds heavier?
Well, it's very straightforward, basically. Like, as humans, we're getting bigger. So something has to give here. Now, I've made the point that this might suit lady riders because naturally they're generally a little bit smaller, so it might encourage them more to become jockeys because it's going to become too difficult for males, basically, who want to make the weight. And I'm interested, Adrian, in the... Why is there... Maybe in Ireland and Britain, they've kind of embraced what to me is a logical and healthy pursuit. Why are other countries reticent about, you know, weights increases, and what is the lobbying there in? Because to me, it just seems like a bit of common sense, really.
It is, Johnny. Actually, just as an aside, last weekend the Dingle race around, pony race around, Wayne Midland actually took some weights and heights on the riders. Of the young 16-year-old riders, the average height was 5'10". The average weight was 8'9". Now, this is 16 years of age.
5'10"?
5'10" wow. And 8'9" was the average. Now, these young lads are going to come into race and try and ride off a minimum weight of 8'4", claiming 10
These are the kids that are the kids that are coming through. If you're average at 5'10", at 16, we're in trouble here, Adrian. You know, I mean, this is like the States, yep, where basically there are no American riders anymore. Do you know what I mean?
Yep. But going back to your initial question, I brought this up at a meeting in London about 4 years ago. We've been meeting once a year of all the European doctors. And I spoke to one of the French officials. And he said, look, Adrian, he said, I fully accept your research. He said, it's a state of mind in France. He said, we haven't got our heads around it yet. He said, maybe when somebody younger replaces me and will accept your research, then we might change. But we've had last year, I mean, for the first time ever, the Trainers Association actually came to HRI and the Turf Club requesting an increase in the weight structure. So when you have the trainers coming to you saying, look, the weights must go up, then, you know, you've really got a problem.
Yeah.
Like, how do you change that opinion in France? How do you get them on board?
I think we have to go to one of the international meetings. They have a meeting on the Monday after the Prix de l'Arc. And we're hoping this year we might manage to get a presence at it and get across our point, because you have 60 racing nations at that meeting. And I'm hoping that we might be able to get a flat out of try and get the point across, at least get them thinking about it. I think if we can at least make a presentation, give the science behind it, tell them what's happening on the ground, at least then I think to me that would be a start.
Yeah. Okay. One last just point in terms of the concussion issue. Obviously, this is something that is revolutionising the sport of American football and is making fairly significant changes to how the tackle is affected in rugby as well. Are there specific changes that will happen in racing, do you think, or ultimately is this about equipment and making sure that if anybody is exhibiting any concussion signs, you just get them out of there?
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously we have all of it based on neuropsych testing. Our helmets are the best helmet that's available currently. I mean, the first job is to prevent catastrophic injury, but I reckon the reduced concussion by probably 95%. I would an average of about 1,800 falls a year. I have only about 20 concussions. Yet of those falls, at least half those falls, potential concussive falls. So the helmets are doing a very good job. There's research going on at a European level for the last 4 years looking to introduce a second standard into helmets, a rotational standard, again, to reduce concussion. We'll probably never stop concussion totally, but we have it down to 20 currently, and I think we will get that lower. But again, concussion, we accept, look, concussion is a traumatic brain injury. I think Ben O'Malley has been out there, and I saw him on CNN 2 nights ago, stating that even a subconcussive blow would cause permanent brain damage. I think we have to stand back. The science does not stand up to that. If that were the case, I would have a lot of demented jockeys around the Curragh. I've lived in the Curragh for the last 34 years among a lot of retired jockeys. They're not all demented. A lot of them are very sharp men in their 80s. So I think we will find that when we eventually get the science, a small number of people who have suffered concussion will have long-term damage, but the vast majority will not have it.
Okay. Adrian, congratulations on an amazing career. When do you actually fully, properly finish up? I mean, I suspect you'll never really finish up.
That's what I was going to say to him. Well, I was watching Mikko the other night, and I was getting quite emotional at the end when Mikko was kind of reflecting on his career. And I'm a little bit worried about where you're going to go now, because I don't think you're going to let this go too easily.
No, I moved sideways on the 31st of December. And I keep saying I didn't move sideways. Obviously, whoever takes over, they will be the boss. But I do fully hope to be involved long term. I'm only 65. I hope to knock another 20 years out of it.
Kevin Prendergast is 86.
Exactly, and going strong. Absolutely.
Adrian, great stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. It's been great. Thank you.
Sure, Johnny, thank you both very much indeed. Thank you.
It's Adrian Goldrick from HRI offices. People were going, oh, that's a nice collection of books he has. But actually, that is a room in the HRI offices in the Curragh.
It does look like a nice collection of books.
I think, as far as I know, it's... Would it be every registered? Does every horse that gets registered for a license every year, so that's them going back since the 1700s? I'm pretty sure I was in the room once.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, they have like... Literally, so that's every horse owner registered at the start of the year gets published in the book. Would that be right? That
yeah, I wasn't aware of that. Like,
every day's a school day.
I'd have a penchant for the old bit of history, and it was very impressive. He looked a little bit small with the way the camera was set up, but he's a giant among men in terms of what he's done. And you speak to jockeys, and they don't really get animated about racing a lot of the time. They kind of prefer to talk about other stuff, like a lot of sports. And if you ask them about him, it's game over. Everything changes. The role he's had in their lives transcends the professional role that he has. And you know, you have stories of where he's gone out for dinner with his wife and just about to order the starter, and he gets a call that, you know, such a rider has just gone to hospital precautionary. He's down the road in an hour and a half to get there to see if everything's all right. Stay there for an hour, come back. 3 or 4 hours later, his wife said a few drinks, and Dr. Adrian hasn't done anything because he doesn't do the job. He lives the job.
Yeah.
And the turf club will miss him greatly when now he's, as you said, he's moving sideways.
We're making a little short film about our trip to Kilbeggan last week, and one of the people we spoke to was Dr. Richard Downey, who is the racecourse doctor in Kilbeggan and a load of other courses, and also works for the turf club too. So he kind of sees both sides of that, and he's the one who's actually in the ambulance driving around chasing the horses. There's two doctors in Kilbeggan because you can't drive the whole way around, so they hand over at one point. There's some courses, I think Galway has three doctors that are in the different ambulances because of the turns. And just the description of what it's like to be there in that moment when something happens, like,
festival thing.
You never really think about these things. Like, we don't think about those things. We go to the races, you get your race cards, you have your bets, you have the crack. It's like but you know, these are big beasts that are jumping over huge fences and they're falling from a high height.
If you're in a 20 runner hurdle race at Cheltenham and you're making the run and your horse falls all of a sudden at a hurdle and you've 20 horses coming over you, not to mind the fall you're going to have, not to mind what your own horse is going to do with you, you've probably about five other jockeys are there straight away trying to avoid you. So if you see somebody in the bookies who's imploring one of the rival horses to fall, you might just remind him that guy could all of a sudden be breaking his neck. Like, I mean, yeah. It's...
Or the clowns who accuse people of jumping off horses.
Yeah, like, I mean, so, you know, as Ruby did on that that little video online and getting a troll to jump out of a car at 40 miles an hour. If you want to do that, but not only that, you're not expecting it to happen either. So it's not something that you're actually prepping for.
Yeah.
You know, in I think it was 2003, we lost three riders that year. Kieran Kelly, Sean Cleary, and Timmy Houlihan. And I would imagine for Dr. Adrian, that was probably the lowest time of his life in terms of his career. JT McNamara passed more recently, and we've obviously had a lot of paralysis cases as well. But all the work he's doing is literally, you know, preventing those occurrences. And I'm really proud of what he spoke about there, of the research they're doing and all the officials that they have to actually work on psychology, on all the different aspects. And it's like as if this will never end, because we just have to keep improving.
No, completely. But investment helps with that kind of stuff, and it helps to raise standards and change culture and make everybody think, I need to do my workout today, otherwise if I fall off I'm going to get injured and won't be back as quickly. I mean, you forget too that they're all independent contractors, they're self-employed. It's an unbelievably difficult job that the jockeys have. Speaking of which, let's talk about some of the races that are happening.
This is unbelievably difficult. We're going to do a trifecta in the Cambridge.
Okay, so the Cambridge goes to post at 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon in the Curra. It's the Tote Irish Cambridgeshire, to give it its full title, obviously. And so what we're going to do this week is you are going to pick...
We're going to go for the trifecta.
How does this work, right? Because my inkling was that you pick three horses and they finish first, second, third, and away you go, and that's it.
That's
it explained?
Pretty much is it, but the challenge is actually getting the trifecta up. So the trifecta is your first, second, and third. Now, in a handicap,
is it a reverse? Like,
what we're going to do here is, I spoke to the great Joe Hennessy from the Tote, who challenged me with this week, and actually offered to buy me lunch there, and I couldn't just do it about 2 hours ago. And when you're offered a free lunch and you can't,
I'm like,
race with you. I just couldn't do it. So we're going to go with three horses basically, and Two of those three have to finish first and second in either order. So basically I'm telling you the winner and the second coming from three horses. And then the rest of the field, any of them can come third. So basically you have 3x2, so you have three potential winners. Two of the other three then must come second. And then basically, you know, something else will finish third, obviously. So you have the field
and
after
that. And that gets you the trifecta up.
That gets the trifecta up. As Joe points out, there have been some whopping dividends in the trifecta in this race. In for example, last year, Elusive Time won the race at 25-1. And there was a, if I have it here, there was
21 grand the winner got.
Yeah, like, so.
For the trifecta.
It can be done. And obviously, you're going to need a few selections, but there is money rolled over into it already. But we're going to go with, so I'll give you the number here, 19 Sir Jack Thomas. He's my idea of the winner of the race.
7-1 at the moment.
Yeah, to be chased home by either of three or four, and that's Lucius Tiberius or Firmament, or Lucius Tiberius or Firmament to win the race with Sir Jack Thomas finishing second. So basically those three horses have to, in some order, fill the first two places, and then thereafter you have the rest of the field to finish third. So the dividend should be pretty decent. You want a real long shot to finish third, ideally. So I think that works out at, to my mind, it works out at 114. So if you have 100 euro, that's probably like a 90 cents per selection,
yeah,
pretty much. So you can work out the maths. But if we have 100 euro, there are 114 selections. So it's basically, as I reiterate, we've three horses who one of the three must finish first. One of the other two must then finish second, and then you have the rest of the field to finish. Actually, I've made a slight mistake here. It works out at exactly 120.
Okay.
So it's 20 horses can finish third, including obviously one of the three that we selected. So it's 120. 120 and 100 is...
65.
It's about 82.5 cents or something like that.
That'd be right, yeah.
So that's so it's 120 selections.
I'm nodding sagely there.
Three by two by 20.
Yeah, okay.
Basically, yeah.
So you picked 19, 4 and 3.
Yeah.
Lucius and, Tiberius.
And then the rest of the field to finish third, which will happen.
Okay.
But it's obviously it's a very competitive race. And the reason we're bringing this bet up, even though it's difficult, is you got to play the exotics. Like you want the big wins and you can do it for very small money. And that's where the tote is still extremely enjoyable way to bet by doing the place pot.
Yeah.
And the pick six and bets like the trifecta.
You can do that for a tenner as opposed to we've got 100 euro, obviously, for the injured jockeys, courtesy of the tote.com. So that's your trifecta. But just to talk to us a bit about this race then. So you obviously like Lucius Tiberius.
Yeah, Sir Jack Thomas is probably my main selection. Now, he's trained by Johnny Murta, who obviously was mentioned there by Dr. Adrian, who was instrumental in him starting off. But Johnny Murta's having a great season. He's had more winners in flat turf in Ireland this year than any other season, and we've a long way to go yet. So I think he's really progressing as a trainer. His owner here is Qatar Racing, Sheikh Fahad Al Thani, so big, big owners. And Sheikh Fahad's been, you know, great for Irish racing. You know, it's great that these wealthy Arab owners are in Ireland for so long, and he's one of the Qatar have gotten more involved in recent years, and he seems to have a real grow for Ireland. Like he's ridden in charity races, and he's a very friendly type guy with the and very, by all accounts, fairly normal bloke. Despite I suppose his upbringing and all that, and he has this Sir Jack Thomas. He's a really likable 3-year-old. He loved a bit of ease in the ground. And the other two then that I do like in the race are Firmament, who's trained by Cork native David O'Mara, ran a blinder the last day, a little bit unlucky. And Lucius Tiberius is a progressive Aidan O'Brien trained 3-year-old. And Aidan's horses are coming right back into form, I think. So they're my three. And then you have basically 20 possible horses to finish third.
Yeah, it's a big old race.
It's a big race, yeah. And you'll need luck in running. I should mention Joseph O'Brien as well. He has a horse running in the... I think it's a 215. Now, this is interesting. This is a 26 runner handicap. And I think this horse will just about be odds against. And, you know, he's one of those.
I don't like those odds.
I would just have a bet and relax and watch him win. Perfect Tapatino.
Perfect Tapatino in the
Perfect Tapatino.
215.
Used to be trained by Damien English in North County Dublin.
Right.
Now in owning with Joseph. Drawn 15. He was a mad hot favourite in Ballinrobe recently, and the meeting was called off. So now is his day of basically redemption, I suppose.
Tell me, this meeting at this time of the year in the Curragh, what is it like? Where are we? Where like the 3-year-olds that you're seeing in the Cambridgeshire? Where are we going to see them?
Yeah, I suppose they could progress to run into listed or group company. But I think the most interesting. This isn't in. It's not a top class card in terms of the non handicap races, but. I suppose the big talking point is this horse that Aidan trains, who only ran last Saturday. He's by no name ever, if I can actually get the time up here. And he made a huge, huge impression, basically first time out. And Aidan to send him out a week later is actually quite staggering. Aidan wouldn't normally send a horse straight from debut into what is the 325, the Round Tower Stakes, sponsored by John Sisk and Son. This horse called 10 Sovereigns. He's by no name ever, and he absolutely bolted up on debut last week. He just centred the track, just pulled away, and he turns out straight away for a group race. And he's going to be a very sharp price favourite now, but he's very exciting. And no name ever is a stallion that Aidan, I think this is his first year of 2-year-olds. He's quite an exciting stallion by Scott Daddy, who's dead. So no name ever is continuing on maybe his legacy as a stallion. And this lad is definitely going to be his flag bearer, judging by his debut effort.
10 Sovereigns.
10 Sovereigns, yeah. He's going to be short, but he's one for your accumulators at the weekend.
And where does he go next?
Okay. So he could go Middle Park at Newmarket. See, Aidan will have other horses in for the 7 furlong races later on. It'll depend. I think the fact that he brought him out a week later would imply that he's maybe trying to keep him apart from some of the Galileo horses that he has upcoming. But he's loads of pace, this horse, so he's obviously come out of his race very well to be to be there a week later. But I'd say the National Stakes, which is on Champions Weekend in, what's that now? 2 weekends time is all. Yeah. That'll probably be off the agenda, but he will have other horses for that.
We have a big, big show coming up ahead of Champions Weekend. It's going to be a Friday night in the Leopardstown Inn. We're going to tell you how you can get tickets for that. An unbelievable guest list already lined up in terms of the...
That's the eve of it, isn't
it? Star-studded guest that we're going to be bringing. So we'll be announcing that next week and the details of that. But yeah, so the eve of the Friday night of Champions Weekend. So whatever you're doing, if you're into your racing and you like us here on Off The Ball, then pay attention. And
on the old Champions Weekend, I know. HRI have a big role in the show, and I don't want to give false platitudes, but actually it's looking to be a hell of a festival now. It looks like obviously Alpha Centauri is going to run, but it looks like Roaring Lion and Saxon Warrior are going to clash again in the Champions Stakes. I spoke to Aidan O'Brien yesterday, and that is going to be an absolute hell of a race. Like it's my favorite race of the year, full stop, in anywhere in the world. Right. It's milers versus mile and a half horses, 3-year-olds versus older horses, males versus females over the interim trip of a mile and two at a brilliant racetrack in Leopardstown. So get yourself there, and obviously get yourself to the Lep Inn as well. You wouldn't even need to go home. You could just stay in the Lep Inn.
Yeah, yeah. Or you could, if this Club 92 still open these days, probably isn't, is it?
You know,
closed.
You know it's still open.
Is it?
No, it's still
all right. Okay. Somebody texting in, you need to be Russell Crowe and a beautiful mind to understand the trifecta bet. You don't. You pick three horses and you hope they come in.
Yeah, it's basically 1, 2, 3, but I don't want it in a particular order. Because if you wanted 1, 2, 3 in a particular order, that's one bet. But trying getting that up is like the equivalent of getting the lotto up. So basically, I've 3 horses. One of those 3 has to win. One of the other 2 has to then finish 2nd, and anything can finish 3rd. That's it. Russell Crowe will get that as well.
Straight down the barrel of the camera like an old bro. Look at him.
To be fair, I didn't explain it very well initially.
You're a man of expensive tastes.
On occasion.
Wow.
On occasion. I was in Aldi on Monday.
To celebrate the 4th annual, I love Aldi. It's brilliant.
Could not get over the value.
It's amazing.
I spent 25 quid and I was like, it was a workout to bring the box out of the shop, and stuff has fallen out of the box. But I wouldn't pay like the 50 cent for the bag or whatever. It's unbelievable value.
That is the very definition of a false economy. Anyway, to celebrate the 4th annual Oyster Festival at the Shelbourne, which runs from September the 1st to the 30th, so that's next month, today's the very last day of August, we're giving one lucky follower the chance to win an Oyster Festival tasting menu experience in the Saddle Room at the Shelbourne for 4 people with a bottle of champagne. For more information, visit shelburnedining.ie and get onto our Facebook page right now to enter that competition. Terms and conditions apply. You have got to be over 18, and the prize is only valid from September the 1st to the 30th. But to celebrate, they've sent in some champagne for us.
Unbelievable. Oh, man.
You got champagne. Hello, yeah, you're so Gary, are you?
Gary, yes.
Nice to meet you, Gary. Thanks very much.
Stephanie, come on.
Hi, Stephanie, how are you? So this has become an annual tradition. The first year, Brian O'Driscoll was here, and they were like, oh, no, if Johnny's coming in, we'll do it when he's in this week.
I absolutely love oysters. This is just fantastic. Are you an oyster man?
Oh, yeah. Who isn't?
Well, this. And obviously being from Galway as well.
Yeah, Clarenbridge at the Oyster Festival.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
These are Irish oysters?
They are Galway Bay oysters.
Ah, very good. Yeah. Perfect.
Taste of the sea.
And so, what's the crack with
these,
Gary?
I had a big lunch.
What have we got?
Great, so today we have the Galway Bay oysters, served with a little bit of dill oil, fresh lemon, and a mignonette.
That's not my normal game here, so there's no point in that. All right,
give me a little squirt there as well.
Hey.
Of lemon.
So go on, sorry I interrupted you.
It's no problem. So we're celebrating our Oyster Festival. So we're launching tomorrow at the Shelbourne Hotel, and we've got live music all weekend from 1 to 5 to help us kick off the festival. We're going to have oyster specials all throughout the month of September. We have Oyster Festival tasting menu in our Saddle Room restaurant.
They're ridiculous.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to be at Shelbourne Park, but instead I'm going to be at the Shelbourne.
So yeah, it kicks off all throughout the month of September. You really should only eat oysters once beginning with ending in or. So it's the freshest of the oysters you can get.
So today technically Ireland we shouldn't be, but...
How are the oysters around Ireland compared to elsewhere?
They're world-renowned oysters, and we're blessed. A lot of people don't realise that in Ireland, with just how lucky we are to have such an amazing selection of oysters here. I spent many years in the States, and none even compare it to the oysters we have here in this island. So,
why is that? Do you have any idea why? Like, what's
I suppose just the Irish coastal waters, the flavours which the Atlantic imparts on the oysters itself, and the traditional farming methods which we can continue to have here in Ireland.
Yeah, we're a bit funny in Ireland that we don't eat enough fish, considering.
Not at all. We eat far too much chicken.
Yeah.
You know, we should eat more rabbit, we should eat more like venison, we should eat more game, and we should eat more of this and more seafood.
The rabbit we kind of poisoned with the mixo back in the day. So maybe we should stick with the stuff that's fresh from the sea.
This is absolutely delicious.
It is amazing, isn't it?
I'm blown away. Nothing. Suddenly my life is worthwhile.
They are amazing.
Yeah.
So the whole month long.
The whole month long, yeah. And for people who may haven't tried oysters before, we do offer a whole selection of cooked oysters, which is a good way to introduce yourself to oysters. And then as soon as you know, develop a taste for that, you can work your way onto the raw oysters, just for anyone who hasn't tried them yet.
You're just being nice to them though, really. Because really cooking them, kind of, does it not take away the whole benefit?
It does, yeah, but some people are scared of to eat raw oysters. Yeah. And for those people, we do have alternative options. But, you know, of course, I would suggest trying them raw.
Yeah.
It's the best way to eat them.
Just taste of the sea.
Yeah.
It really does.
And chew them. Don't,
yeah.
Like that, the whole point of texture is get used to it.
Get the flavor.
Release it, yeah. Gary, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the champagne.
We'll have Gary on again.
You can leave the bottle if you want.
Yeah, absolutely.
Look, there's a couple of other quick stories we need to talk about.
I want to eat the oysters.
we can eat and talk. Sam Crowe, right, what's the story?
What is the story with Sam Crowe? We need to get Eddie O'Leary on. And we need to get Michael or Eddie O'Leary on.
We could fix that for next week.
We could get Michael to talk about how the unions have basically somehow gotten a role in Ryanair. You know, he's getting a little bit softer. But is Michael, is he soft enough to not send this horse over fences? Because he has to go chasing.
Explain to us, right. So Sam Crowe is a hurdler.
He's a hurdler, but he's a hurdler, but he's an embryo chaser. So like he's
you know,
because of his physique and the background that he's come from as well, in the sense of point to pointing, and you know, he's just a beautiful specimen. I actually had a little bit of an argument with Brendan Duke, the well known commentator, son of the same named trainer, earlier on about his hurdling technique. He's good at his hurdles, but I don't think he's amazingly good. And I think over fences he'd be so exciting. He'd be a horse of the ages. I think pragmatically they're looking at the champion hurdle picture this season and saying that it's not that strong. But if he goes to champion hurdle this season, and Eddie O'Leary has said he is going to go chasing, it's just a matter of when. So if he goes to champion hurdle this season and presumably goes novice chasing in the following season, he'll have spent a year in bumpers, a year as a novice hurdler, a year as a senior hurdler, a year as a novice chaser. And then in his fifth season, we're seeing what he was designed to do, senior chasing. And Francois Dumain, the trainer, said, you're lucky to get 5 years out of a horse. So notwithstanding his point-to-point career, it's his fifth season when we'll see him as a senior chaser. I'm like, forget about it, just go now, because that's what I think he was designed to do, and that's what Jigginson Town buy these horses for.
To be chasers.
Absolutely, but
the chasers are the big races, the ones that everybody, Gold Cups.
There's nothing wrong with the champion hurdle, nothing wrong with Harchbald, Hardy Uses, yada yada, but those horses wouldn't have made it over fences. This horse could be one of the true greats over fences, and it would be a sight to behold. Imagine riding him in a race over fences in a 2 mile champion chase. Like, maybe he wouldn't get the Gold Cup trip.
Okay, Grant, so he's a shorter.
It's up for debate. Like, I remember last year when presenting Percy ran at Cheltenham, I put up a poll on Twitter, who's going to be the more likely Gold Cup winner, presenting Percy or Sam Crowe? And the vast majority of people said presenting Percy, because they don't think Sam Crowe is going to stay a Gold Cup trip. I think he'd be more of a 2 miler. But the debate now, I thought the debate would be, is he a champion chaser or a Gold Cup horse? Not is he a hurdler or a chaser, because he's a chaser to my mind.
And what's the 2 mile hurdle?
That would be the champion hurdle.
Okay.
Which, to be fair, is up for grabs this season. I think he'd win it if he went down that route.
And the 2 mile over fences?
That's the champion chase, which is, you know, arguably the best race in jumps racing when you have like Moscow Flyer versus Desertio versus Well Chief. You know, the hairs stand up in the back of my shoulder and back of my neck just seeing that now. And I think a lot of people at home can get to it. Like, chasing at 2 miles at top speed is just absolutely exhilarating. We saw Footpad this season, how exciting he was. I want to see Sam Crowe doing that. I think a lot of other people do too, but they have a decision to make.
It's basically like the 400 meters of hurdles.
Yeah.
Where you've got the absolute best athletes sprinting the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not just the stairs.
You know that if they get it wrong, it's, you know, that's what's on the line. And we spoke to Adrian McGoldrick. They're the races where, you know, the jockeys really, their bravery comes out to the fore.
Tiger Roll is making a return. There's no doubts about what Tiger Roll's future is, are there? They're just talking about specific races.
Yeah, he's what a horse he's been. I guess they'll go for something similar this year in terms of the national and all that. And you know, he was a horse. Funnily enough, that was Jigginson bought him off the flat, and he became what he became, which is quite astonishing. But what a horse he's been! And it's when the evenings start getting shorter, you start thinking of the jumps. And I think Lesole is kind of, it brings you sort of thinking that way as well. That's going to be a hell of a festival Sunday week. And, you know, all of the top horses are now back in training as well. So, you know, it's going to be exciting times ahead.
Johnny, good stuff. Enjoy the weekend. Here's hoping the trifecta comes off and we can raise some money for the injured jockeys. There might be one left.
I did get a free lunch.
Hey, there you go. Only here. That is your lot on Friday Night Racing this week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Thanks very much to our friends at goracing.ie for making all of this possible. And get over to our Facebook page and enter that competition if you fancy an oysters tasting menu at the Shelburne. We'll see you next week. Good luck.
Friday Night Racing.
On Off The Ball.
And they're off.
Brought to you by Go Racing. Plan your day at the races at goracing.ie.